This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.
My guest today is probably the world's most famous college dropout. Of course, there have been other monikers over the years. Computing pioneer, richest man in the world, global philanthropist, even tech supervillain. Whatever your take on Bill Gates, after years at the corporate coalface, building a software empire and a vast fortune, his priority now is giving that away. And his ethos for doing it has been shaped by his international experiences and by science. Famed for co-founding the software company Microsoft, for the past 25 years, Bill's attention has been focused on philanthropic efforts via the Gates Foundation, one of the largest charities in the world. There, Bill and his billions have taken on issues around health, inequality, education, and climate change in some of the world's poorest countries. And their impact has been undeniable, from helping eradicate wild poliovirus in Africa to supporting efforts which, over the past 25 years, have more than halved global child mortality rates. Bill says none of this work is easily accomplished, but most goals worth achieving aren't. And as I suspect we'll hear over the next half hour, he's not a man to opt for the easy route when there's a tougher challenge to take on. Bill Gates, welcome to Life Scientific.
Thank you.
Now, Bill, you invest more money in science each year than most countries, and you have a reputation as a real science enthusiast, not just in terms of tech. What feeds that enthusiasm?
Well, in the year 2000, because of the wealth created by my Microsoft ownership, I started a foundation focused on health in poor countries and then education in the United States. And it was stunning to find that millions of deaths were things that could be prevented, deaths from malaria, diarrhea, pneumonia. And so that became our primary focus, getting vaccines to be cheap, inventing new vaccines, and partnering up with governments and getting all those vaccines to kids. And it was a kind of almost mind-blowingly successful effort, which led to that reduction in childhood deaths from 10 million to 5 million that you mentioned. So I was looking at the fact that kids were dying at 40 times the rate in poor countries versus in the US or the UK. And strangely, a vaccine for diarrhea, a form called rotavirus, was actually available to the rich kids. But because there was no money, the kids who were 100 times more at risk of dying didn't have that vaccine. Now, we had to reduce the cost below a dollar and organize the funding, but that and other vaccines are the main reason that those death rates were so rapidly reduced.
We're going to unpack some of that later on, but I want to find out a bit more about you, Bill Gates. Well, in between the reading, the watching goofy programs, certainly your international philanthropy, you also find time to fit in a little exercise, I gather, specifically something called pickleball.
Yeah, there's a racket sport that was created about 50 years ago, but about 15 years ago, it started catching on, primarily in the U.S., because it uses a much smaller court than tennis. It's badminton-sized, and the equipment is pretty simple. You can actually, if you have a flat cement driveway, you can make a court. And so over time, people have found that learning to play it is very easy. So I love both tennis and pickleball. I play about equally.
Well, Bill Gates, you were born in 1955 in Seattle, Washington. Your father, Bill Gates Sr., was a successful lawyer. I gather he talked to you and your two sisters about his cases over dinner.
Yeah, our parents shared, you know, what was going on in their world and got us fascinated by that.
Your mother, Mary, was a teacher before having kids, but after that, she did a huge amount of volunteering and community work, didn't she?
Yeah, and then eventually there came a period where people wanted women on boards, serious company boards, and because she had the background for that, she was in very high demand.
Did her volunteering community work have an impact on you, an influence on you growing up?
Well, certainly this idea of volunteering time and giving, both of my parents, you know, would get us to go lick stamps for politicians or hold up signs for the school levy. And they talked about groups like Planned Parenthood or various groups that would try and educate voters. So they had causes that they put their time into. You know, they gave back a lot to the university they both went to. And so, yeah, they set an example of generosity.
What were you like as a kid? I hear you were already a big reader and a big thinker.
I had a deep sense of curiosity, and because they'd read a lot of books to me, then as I started to read, you know, I was pretty voracious. You know, some things like the Tarzan series, there's like 100 of those, or the Martian series, or everything Heinlein wrote. So a lot of science fiction, but then a lot of just pure, you know, math or science type books, and often through the lens of the lives of the scientists, the history of science.
Well, you clearly found your niche at secondary school. You attended Lakeside Prep, where the Mothers Club raised funds for a school computer terminal. And you then discovered a flair for programming.
Right. The teachers were somewhat intimidated by this machine. And I got drawn in because people knew I was good at math. So they said, okay, can you figure this thing out? And that got me intrigued.
You wrote your first software program, I gather, while still in your early teens, a noughts and crosses game.
Yeah, I was 13 when I had this exposure and was started with very simple programs, including that one.
Well, you and a group of friends of yours who were equally entranced by computers started the Lakeside Programmers Club. And I gather you helped the school, even local companies, with programming their systems, getting rid of bugs and so on.
Yeah, we got a chance to use a computer for free as long as we could find problems. And so we got more sophisticated at that. Then later on, we got paid to write a payroll program. And then actually our school needed all the classes scheduled, which was fairly complex. And eventually they hired me and these friends to do that schedule. And that was fun. It was actually pretty hard to do.
What was it about the world of code and creation that fascinated you?
Well, there's an interactivity where if your program's wrong, you know, it doesn't work, and then you change it, and you think through, okay, what was wrong? You know, even that problem of scheduling classes, how do you minimize the disruption? And, you know, people have all these requests, I don't want it, too many classes in a row, and dance class needs long periods, and labs need long periods. And it had a really endearing level of complexity, you know, in how to do it.
I mentioned your Programmers Club. One of its members was Paul Allen, your eventual co-founder of Microsoft. And of course, we're going to come back to him. But one of your closest friends was a boy called Kent Evans, who very sadly, while you were still in your junior year, lost his life in a mountain climbing accident.
Yeah, well, Kent was my closest friend. He and I were in the same grade. And the other two boys were two grades ahead of us, including Paul. And Kent and I were actually working on the scheduling thing. And he wasn't at all athletic, so it was kind of unusual. He went off to do a mountain climbing course. And it was while he was practicing mountain climbing that he was killed. Just, you know, so unexpected. And, you know, he was an amazing kid with incredible potential. And, you know, we'd been brainstorming about things. You know, he was the one who got me reading Fortune magazine, because although in math and science I was hardcore, he was more the, hey, you know, what job should we do? What companies should we work for? Should we be a general or an ambassador or all sorts of different professions that he was looking up?
How did you deal with that loss?
Well, I was pretty sad for quite a while. And it did mean that I reached out to Paul Allen, to finish this scheduling thing that I'd committed to do over the summer. So Paul actually had started college, but came back, and he and I were working together, and it was at that time he was talking about computers going on to a chip. He was more of a hardware person, but I'm sure I immersed myself in that programming work. So that it was a very intense summer after Kent's death.
Well, Bill, this was the early 70s, and as you say, there was a growing buzz around computers. At that point, computers were still huge, unwieldy systems. But you were already confident that personal computers in every office and home was going to be the future.
Yeah, so the shrinkage of transistors onto chips was leading to, exponential capability per chip. That meant that these mini computers that were like $50,000 each would come on a chip that would cost like $10. And, I understood that that meant you would need software that would make it valuable, help people be productive, what became word processors and spreadsheets. And so we understood that. And we're like, wow, how come everybody's not just, how come it doesn't blow their mind? How come they don't see this coming? And as that prediction was coming true, and I'd gone off to Harvard, he came back to Boston and said, the revolution's going to happen without us. And so he convinced me that, I needed to drop out.
Well, you started at Harvard, this is 1973, studying maths and computer science. But as you say, you did drop out, and you and Paul Allen started writing software for this company, MITS, when they launched their new microcomputer, the Altair 8800.
Yeah, so we called these guys up and said, okay, we'll write software for you. And so we worked hard and went out and demonstrated a thing called BASIC that would make it simple to write programs for this $400 personal computer.
I remember BASIC very well. It was the language I learned to program in when I started my physics degree. That was in the early 80s, so clearly we progressed from there to other languages. But yes, I have fond memories of BASIC. So there you were, age 19, dropping out of Harvard to launch this partnership with Paul Allen, which you named Microsoft. And your Microsoft years have been extensively covered, Bill, so I don't want to linger on well-trodden ground. But just to recap for listeners, in the early 80s, you developed an operating system for IBM's new personal computers, PC-DOS, and went on to market your own version, MS-DOS, which cemented Microsoft's leading position in the tech world. In 1983, Paul Allen left the company after being diagnosed with Hodgkin lymphoma. As people may know, he sadly passed away back in 2018. But back in those early Microsoft years, you then transitioned into a more managerial role. You were obviously extremely capable. You had a bright team around you, but you were still young. I mean, did you feel any sense of pressure?
No, I was very lucky. A close friend of mine, Steve Ballmer, came in to run the company with me. And then we hired some adults who understood that, we had a vision and that they were there in support of that vision, but that their deep skills in, sales or finance or legal needed to shape how we took that vision forward. And so the company kept growing. We went public. We kept hiring people. So it was magic. And we made some missteps, but, eventually a lot of the software people used, like spreadsheets and word processors, we managed to make the best. So Microsoft Office became an extremely popular and profitable franchise.
So, Bill, you stepped down as Microsoft CEO in 2008, then also left your role as chair in 2014 to spend more time with the foundation. And as you've mentioned, of course, you cover this broad spectrum from green energy to nutrition to immunization. Tell me about some of the projects you're most proud of.
Well, the idea that there was a vaccine that was given to rich kids, this diarrheal vaccine rotavirus, and it wasn't being given to the kids who would benefit wildly from it. I mean, that really struck me as, that sometimes market-based incentives don't lead to the human outcomes that we'd like to see. And some partnerships of governments and philanthropists ought to change that. And so I'd say our work on vaccines, including a group called Gavi that funds vaccines for poor countries, you know, that's what we're most proud of because it's been such a big part of that massive death reduction.
But also just encouraging immunization in general. Of course, that's come to the fore with the pandemic, but it's changing mindsets, changing attitudes and trust, I guess, in medicine.
Well, we actually have more vaccine skepticism in rich countries than we do in developing countries. Part of the reason for that is that they see measles deaths all the time. And so when you say this measles vaccine will make sure that doesn't happen to your kid, it's more vivid than in the rich world where it's not responsible to not get a measles vaccine, but the chance that you'll pay a price for it is actually quite low. So, yeah, there's a constant effort. Even with our work on polio eradication, we've had countries where rumors about the vaccine being to sterilize women have been spread, and only by having the religious leaders come and vaccinate their kids, get the word out, somebody that's deeply trusted, were we able to reverse that and continue our eradication efforts.
Green energy solutions are also a big focus for you.
Yeah, so I was working in Africa and seeing that most people there, of course, are farmers with very small plots of land. You know, they're the ones who are vulnerable to the high heat and that, you know, when they get a bad growing season, that leads to their kids being malnourished. Almost 40% of children in Africa are malnourished. And so the irony that it's actually there in Africa that the greatest suffering is taking place, even though all these emissions are the rich temperate zone countries. And so I did spend a lot of time getting educated about, okay, how tough is this going to be, particularly for Africa, and decided that, yes, making better seeds and getting involved in reducing these warming effects would be important for my goal of having every country be self-sufficient.
I should just mention here that organizations that we just discussed, like Gavi, have faced criticism over the years for giving private donors the power to dictate global health goals. I mean, it's hard to argue with eradicating disease or helping disadvantaged kids get immunized, but this does speak to a bigger issue, namely that controlling such a huge organization is a massive responsibility. How do you wield that sort of power fairly?
Well, Gavi, you know, I'm a donor to Gavi. We're about 18% of their funds. The biggest backer is actually the British government at about 20%. And, you know, it's not that complicated when your goal is saving lives. You can say in education, you know, should kids learn calculus or not, or should they have a long school day or do a lot of homework? In health, families want their kids to grow up and achieve their mental and physical potential. So the aims are pretty non-controversial. The Gates Foundation, which I'm in a certain sense in charge of, we've picked things like malaria. And I'd say it's a sad fact that there's not more government and philanthropic money in malaria. And so it does create a very high bar that we better spend our malaria money well. Because it's a very high percentage of all the malaria money is what's coming from us. The majority of the research money is literally one organization. That's mad, but that's the world we live in.
I mean, clearly you make choices for the right reasons, but of course there are sort of, you know, what are called the Cinderella diseases and problems around the world which don't get highlighted. But I guess that's inevitable. You know, well, you can't spread your wealth equally everywhere. You have to presumably make choices.
Well, our choice is the diseases that kill the most children. I have no particularly, you know, bias about this. I knew very little about malaria or TB or, you know, these awful diseases called neglected tropical diseases where, you know, a gift of $1 million can cover an entire country and make sure nobody has to suffer for these things. And, you know, they're very far away and it's hard to get people's attention to these things.
Well, Bill, in 2020, as the pandemic took hold, you established the COVID-19 Therapeutics Accelerator to help speed up the development of drugs to treat the virus. So you really were at the forefront of the scientific action. What did that experience during the pandemic teach you?
Well, I wouldn't say it was me, but the foundation, because of our work, we have more expertise on vaccines than anyone except the pharmaceutical companies. So we immediately funded the world's highest volume vaccine company. We sent them $400 million to make vaccines for the world, which they worked together with AstraZeneca and actually were the highest volume maker of that. It was a crisis for the entire world, and we had resources. We could make quick decisions. You can look back and say, okay, were we listened to? But it was an awful thing. We're still in terms of deaths and mental health and learning loss and loved ones who died. We're still paying a price for not having handled that well at all.
And people will know, of course, that you became the subject of various outlandish conspiracy theories during the pandemic. Things like using vaccines not to protect, but rather cull the world population, or to secretly implant people with microchips as a means of mind control. How do you make sense of that reaction?
Well, you've got to have a sense of humor. When people say that I want to track everyone, why do I want to track everyone? I had a woman come up and yell at me on the street. You planted a vaccine in me. And I'm like, wow, I really don't need to know your location. Sorry. And the idea that during crises, people seek oversimplistic explanations, and having somebody behind the curtains, Tony Fauci, me, George Soros, who knows, people have that shortcut, because the truth is actually fairly complicated about what there's bats and there's pangolins and there's receptors in your lungs and, really complicated. And of course, the scientists were confused. Even today, there's a few things that we're still trying to understand about this particular epidemic. But, the vaccines came fairly rapidly, including a form that we'd been funding for a long time called mRNA, because we're going to use mRNA for malaria, HIV, and TB. And that's why we had funded people like BioNTech and Moderna and CureVac. But yes, there were a lot of crazy misinformation that sort of said, okay, he's involved with vaccines and he's giving billions. But, instead of saving millions, apparently I'm making billions and killing millions. And it's right, except it's just the opposite sign, a minus instead of a plus.
Well, Bill, in 2021, you and Melinda announced that you decided to divorce. There was a lot of media coverage, a lot of questions around your personal life, your relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, which I should say have been addressed in previous interviews and was limited. But that must have been a difficult time. You and Melinda continued to work together, of course, at the foundation until this summer when she stepped down, and it's now become simply the Gates Foundation. All these changes, how has that affected you? How does that change the way the foundation works and you personally?
Well, Melinda's a fantastic person. To me, it's still a sad thing that we got divorced. We have three incredible kids that we work together to support. She helped create the foundation, helped shape everything that's good about it. And now, she's got resources off on her own. I'm sure she'll do a great job. And I met with the employees after she made that announcement. She's very clear how proud she is and how she wants us to go on doing exactly that work. It's an incredible organization. It's got all the wealth I have is dedicated to that. And that'll be spent in the next 20 years. And hopefully we'll eradicate some diseases. But in the meantime, she'll be a great philanthropist working on some of the same issues.
And still plenty to be done. I know you're an optimist, Bill, but according to the foundation, 25 of the world's poorest countries now spend more on debt than on education, health, and social protection combined. Meanwhile, we see around us many of the richest nations are turning inwards, dealing with their own internal conflicts, political upheaval, inequality. How can you convince governments that they should be helping other countries, not just their own?
Well, the goal would be to have a a bit less than 1% of a rich country's budget go to saving lives. You know, if you're saving lives for 1,000 times less than you would in your own country, and it's a collective thing where other countries are coming together, if it's creating stability in the toughest places in the world, I would say that even with all these budget constraints, which are incredible, and it's money going to Ukraine, aging population, fixing healthcare, it feels like there's just not enough money to go around. And so we have to prioritize. I don't think we should take foreign aid down. And as we have to economize within that, the things that are super high impact, like Gavi that buys these vaccines, we should make absolutely sure that is maintained at the current level. You know, you're saving lives for so little. People should be so proud of their government for being part of that, because that 1% has a moral and strategic benefit that I think is very, very powerful, and we're making incredible progress.
You changed the course of the world when you were still in your 20s. What message do you have for the next generation?
Well, I pursued my curiosity. You know, even today, I'd say I'm kind of a student, that I like to learn new things. And that's brought a lot of enjoyment, a lot of success, you know, getting to work with great people. So I'd encourage people from a young age to try and see how these pieces fit together and persist in that. But all of these health things are still out there. And even in the 20 years of the foundation, we won't solve all of those problems. And we hope to finish off polio, malaria, and measles are, you know, the next targets for eradication. You know, AI is a new element, and so people need to delve in and, you know, really think about how that should be used. Nobody knows the answer, but there's a lot of potential.
It's been absolutely fascinating. Bill Gates, thank you very much for sharing your life scientific.
Thank you.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.